Okay, so the floor is to Mrs. Patricia Wolf from Princeton University. Please, Patricia.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. With the definition of brain death in 1968 and the many refinements in interpretations of the beginning of life, it's clear that biomedical research has contributed to the redefinition of birth and of death, the very bookends of life. Developments, as you have heard, in the Human Genome Project, in cloning and human embryonic stem cell research have increased the complexity. It is no wonder that these changes are disturbing to ordinary people, to non-scientists. They threaten traditional values and increasingly involve government officials in setting or limiting in setting or limiting the direction of research. In this context, it is more important than ever that fundamental research is trustworthy. American universities, governmental agencies, and professional organizations have undertaken formal programs to instruct and guide future scientists about the responsible conduct of research, now known as RCR, responsible conduct of research, and about ethical dilemmas that may arise from their work. This paper will describe the programs, which include discussions of conflict of interest, of interpersonal relationships in the laboratory, the challenges of collaborative efforts, often between disciplines and cross-cultural, peer review, and the honest conduct and publication of research, all basic issues facing scientists. In the United States today, there are vigorous efforts to address ethical issues associated with this research in the life sciences. The diversity, complexity, and interrelatedness of these problems staggers the mind. The range and specificity of current ethical quandaries associated with biological research is much larger. These include very simple issues such as don't lie, cheat, or steal, and manifestly complex ones such as Dr. Françoise Turenne-Moulin described. Quote, in what respects does a living cell monoculture differ from an as yet undifferentiated cell cluster derived from nuclear transplantation or stem cells? Hundreds of problems of less but sufficient complexity lie between these extremes. In America, we have a propensity for identifying and worrying over bioethical dilemmas. What accounts for this interest? How are its goals defined? What chance do we have of achieving outcomes that justify the interest? Well, we are mindful of our history of ethical failures. Just as one example, the experiment in Tuskegee, Alabama, in which elderly black men with syphilis were not given drugs so that doctors could study the unmedicated course of the disease. There are many others, but it has heightened our awareness of human fallibility. It could be that we are fixed on social and political processes that make it much more difficult to arrive at conclusions in our heterogeneous and opinionated culture. It could also be that as a nation we tend to look for trouble, often in the naive belief that we can find solutions. Sometimes we strive for answers even before the problems are widely known. But other suggestions suggest themselves. The large federal budget for health-related research and the resultant oversight of the United States Congress. Democratic traditions that encourage public participation and debate, even in highly technical matters. Journalistic interest in scandals. Public safety and fear of the unknown in potential scientific dangers. There's no question that these issues are engaged. For example, citizens and non-scientist faculty serve on institutional review boards that reflect on the ethical aspect of research, any research involving humans and animals, even social science research. And these people, the external advisors, have the ability to deny permission to conduct research. Non-scientist members of the public now serve on granting review panels at the National Institutes of Health. Vociferous opponents to scientific research have forced scientific organizations to respond and proactively explain and defend the rationale for research programs. And as you know, the Human Genome Project has a section devoted to the ethical, legal, and social implications of its work, and a fat budget to carry out this mandate. I shall describe three streams of influence on your outline or plan that contributed, I believe, to the interest in research ethics that now manifests itself in lively institutional responses. The first is the protection of human subjects in medical research as originally medical ethics evolved into bioethics and now supplemented by research ethics. The second is scientist self-regulation in the case of the recombinant DNA moratorium. And the third, perhaps the most compelling, are the scandals that were associated with research dishonesty. Dishonest, negligent, and opportunistic practices led to mistrust and skepticism about the goals of the scientific community. Each of these streams generated periods of intense critical interest that led to got the attention of doctors and scientists, then led to governmental responses, and later, as they became part of the cultural landscape, faded from direct public attention. Government interest has often been intrusive and burdensome, as scientists were called to testify before Congress, serve on panels of inquiry, and conform to rules and regulation that limited the autonomy that most scientists believe is necessary to their work. Non-professional interests, especially religious interests in our country, have played a significant role and influenced decisions to limit the sphere of scientific investigations. I'll begin with a brief discussion of how the protection of human research subjects and its origins in medical ethics blended into and led to bioethical issues and eventually became one of these streams. Medical ethics, deeply ingrained in the practice of medicine, traditionally focused on the rights of individuals, individual patients, and the duties of doctors. The advent of modern medical research, particularly in the 20th century, changed the focus from the care for single patients to considerations of how medical knowledge gathered from many individuals could serve the interests of other sick people now and in the future. Horrifying instances of mistreatment, allegedly in the name of science, led to the Nuremberg Code, the Helsinki Code, the United States President's Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects, and enriched medical ethics to include protecting the needs of human and other animal research subjects. Research conducted to test the safety and efficacy of drugs and medical devices also expanded the scope of interest in medical ethics. Protecting human subjects led to the establishments of the IRBs that I've just mentioned. But as compelling as these issues of traditional bioethics were, they did not command the attention of most scientists conducting basic research. There were few course offerings in American universities and practically none in universities that did not have medical schools. Another area, a stream of influence, is that of scientists' self-regulation in the matter of recombinant DNA. Another source of interest stemmed from the development of controlled genetic engineering experiments in the early 1970s. The prompt action of those scientists doing the work to verify the safety of their research protocols resulted in a self-imposed moratorium where they all agreed not to work on these projects until there was a consensus developed among scientists. In 1975, an international conference on recombinant DNA was held at Asilomar State Park in California to recommend controls that would protect against laboratory hazards. Instead of reassuring the public that scientists were mindful of dangers and interested in the protection of the public, these actions attracted attention and led to noisy protests in the streets of several university towns to keep the universities from doing this kind of work. This happened in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and also in Princeton. The National Institutes of Health Controls that were a result of the Asilomar Congress resulted in oversight by a recombinant DNA advisory committee known as the RAC, the RAC. As a fail-safe techniques for genetic engineering experiments were developed, the RAC was kept in place. But in 1978, then later in 1980, revisions weakened the controls. The safety issue has largely disappeared as a matter of public concern in the United States. But safety provided a platform for public interest and another precedent for public participation in science policy. It can also be argued, however, that the focus on public safety preempted concern, distracted concerns about larger and more subtle ethical issues, issues that have become more vivid and compelling since the cloning of Dolly and controversies about the utilization of human embryonic stem cells. And now I turn to research misconduct, untrustworthy research practices. Prior to 1980, reported instances of research fraud were rare. Only the painted mouse of Dr. William Summerlin at Sloan Kettering had drawn public attention and made the front page of the New York Times. Although many scientists knew of one or two cases of suspected dishonesty in research, these situations were handled secretly at the institutions where they occurred, and most often the offender was asked to leave quietly. The fewer questions asked, the better. In the summer of 1980, all of that changed with the disclosure of four notorious cases of research misconduct, or dishonest research, or fraud in research, as it was then known. The publicity and the eminence, the importance of the institutions at which they occurred, including Yale University and Columbia, Boston University, and later Harvard, initiated a spate of public interest and of other allegations. And so 1980 became the decade of misconduct for many scientific researchers in the biomedical area. The congressional hearings were conducted largely under two themes: waste, fraud, and abuse. What are you doing with all of this public money? And two, public health and safety. One hearing was entitled, "Are Scientific Misconduct and Conflicts of Interest Harmful to Our Health?" It also became clear that when high-profile scientists such as Nobel Prize winner David Baltimore and Robert Gallo, who claimed to have discovered the AIDS virus, were accused, congressmen could get favorable publicity as watchdogs of the public interest. Independent professional organizations and research institutions focused then quickly on the responsibility of scientists. They were certainly mindful of the National Institutes of Health as the source of most funding for biomedical research, and they strove to defend the reputation of their research communities. In each of the three illustrative streams, government agencies or legislative bodies entered the discussions, alleging there was a need for official oversight because the doctors or scientists involved were not meeting their professional responsibility. In all cases, there were arguments and evidence that risks needed to be controlled by someone else, someone other than those who benefited from financial support. There was an implicit and sometimes an explicit mistrust of professionals. In the United States, government most frequently influences the course of events by investigation and regulation. Regulation can precede legislation, which is a much more complicated process. We are currently witnessing government oversight of financial markets also growing out of a parallel mistrust of the professionals involved that are reminiscent of the intensity in the 1980s against scientists. Once government agencies of the U.S. Congress are alerted, there is a concerted effort on the part of the target group to detect and clean up any problems before official scrutiny ruins the enterprise with draconic measures. In the case of scientific misconduct, it almost seemed like a contest between professional organizations and universities to take extremely moral positions ahead of the government regulators. There is little doubt that government oversight and bad publicity got the attention of most scientists. Investigations and prosecutions may not have improved laboratory practices, but they drew attention to negligent and opportunistic habits in research. There was also some constructive government action. In 1989 and again in 1990, the National Institutes of Health Guide for Grants and Contract announced a new program that all applications for National Service Award research training grants include a description of programs to provide instruction in the responsible conduct of research. The requirement was honored in many different ways, from single lectures to full course requirements. In 1994, the requirement was reinforced with the following language: applications without plans for instruction in the responsible conduct of research will be considered incomplete and will be returned to the applicant without review. As money is the lifeblood of science, this is a powerful incentive. The letter of instruction offered the following guidance: the NIH will not establish specific curriculum or format requirements. Although they will not do that, all programs are strongly encouraged to consider instruction in the following areas: conflict of interest, responsible authorship, policies for handling misconduct, and policies regarding the use of human-animal subjects and data management. Universities faced many challenges in fulfilling these requirements. For starters, the students didn't want to take the course, and the professors didn't want to teach it. The students preferred to be conducting research, and the supervisors agreed with them. Biology professors do not want to teach research ethics. They believe that they were behaving ethically already. Professional philosophers typically disdain applied ethics. The cadre of potential teachers was not at all obvious. Bioethics had dealt with a limited number of complex individual cases, but not with issues raised in the fundamental expectations of scientific research. Those lessons were supposed to be taught by the principal investigators, the laboratory supervisors, but they had often themselves not been trained to think about those issues. It is also difficult to engage students in discussions of philosophical issues when they are reluctant or unwilling to read basic texts. There were usually no teeth in the requirements, few incentives to do the work. Teaching had to be more of a persuasion, a seduction, even using shock tactics, as I used in one case, a recording of David Baltimore testifying in a congressional hearing, or entertainment, such as films about Watson and Crick's discovery of the structure of DNA that showed their disrespect for Rosalind Franklin, a co-worker in the laboratory. Now, examples had to be relevant to current research and reflect the complexity of living systems. The mandate required instruction in RCR, responsible conduct of research, and does not refer to ethics or bioethics per se. And I believe that is because scientists have traditionally believed that science is ethically neutral. The pursuit of knowledge is considered to be good. Scientists enjoy the luxury of regarding the misuse or unanticipated adverse consequences as not their fault. And yet, the chairman of our department refers almost always to our course as the ethics course. I was invited to teach such a course at Princeton in collaboration with a series of principal investigators from the department. The content was initially developed by three molecular biologists and myself. We agreed that the instruction should be directed primarily toward fostering sound professional behavior, not toward the improvement of character. We decided on a course of 6 lectures, approximately half a semester, in the period just after their formal scientific coursework, when they were beginning their independent research. Much of what governs professional behavior has been developed over years informally in an apprentice system, and scientists resist codification of the implicit values and norms that they feel have served them well. But with the internationalization of science and collaborations across disciplinary boundaries, there are many opportunities for misunderstanding and disagreement. At Princeton University, we focused on ethical issues that were a direct result of the controversies growing out of the research falsification scandals and congressional inquiries. We began with a review of public interest in science and the public financial support for research. Because this course was the result of congressional pressure, we began by considering why the public supports research at all, and what are the mechanisms for allocating research funds in the United States. We questioned whether those who pay for research, the taxpayers, should be able to influence the research agenda, and examined the rationale for investigator-initiated research programs. Faculty members who served on NIH panels were able to provide a detailed review of the procedures of grant application, evaluation, and funding at the National Institutes of Health. We spent a good deal of time on the principles of intellectual property, its protection in law and tradition, including copyrights and patents. We have discussed specific intellectual property issues that arise in proposing, conducting, and reporting research in scientific journals. And these issues naturally led to considerations of confidentiality in the review process and the role of peer review in awarding grants and contracts and in decisions with regard to publication. Dissemination of scientific information and publication in journals is a major issue. Publication is a necessary step in maintaining a scientific community, in furthering scientific progress, and in manifesting the work product resulting from public financial support. Because it is so important to professional advancement, and because authorship of scientific articles is frequently contentious, it is one that challenges mature and young scientists. The criteria for granting authorship were informal and often political. They differed from specialty to specialty, and even from institution to institution, and department to department. As collaborative research became more important, the number of authors on each paper grew, and disputes arose about who should be an author and the order of authorship. The International Committee of Medical Journal Editors, of which I was at the time a member, addressed this issue, and there is now a good deal more agreement on standards for authorship, but it is by no means universal. Collaboration takes place within laboratories, between different departments in the same universities, across languages, with scientists in other institutions, disciplines, and countries. With the benefits of cooperative work, there are also more chances for disagreements based on different assumptions about secrecy and protectionism and openness in scientific exchanges of information and biological materials Scientists have had to confront the difference between the ideal of totally open sharing and the reality of a good deal of protectionism. Research misconduct was the driving force in requiring programs of instruction. We tried to get the students to recognize it and avoid it. Misconduct is the term now officially used to describe research that is dishonest or deliberately misleading. Although critics feel that the term trivializes the worst offense scientists can imagine, it was chosen after many days of conferences and committees. Even today, after years of argument, the definition of misconduct is not entirely uniform across federal agencies, nor fundamentally agreed upon by all scientists. Shocking instances of dishonest research were discovered and disclosed in the early 80s when we still had the capacity to be shocked. This was followed by a decade in which there were many accusations and also more severe violations. Instances of retribution against those who reported scientific fraud or misconduct and sabotage of experiments tarnished the reputation of the research enterprise. In France, you may be familiar with the accusations against Robert Gallo, whose work on the isolation of the AIDS virus drew heavily on that of Dr. Montagné at the Pasteur Institute. We also worked on reciprocal obligations of senior scientists as mentors and students as apprentices, how to avoid conflicts, even issues like sexual harassment, favoritism, and international issues. We struggled with how to teach students to deal with their sympathy for animals in research and the perceived necessity for using animals in experiments to benefit humans. We tried to use these issues as case studies to teach various approaches from moral theory, but in fact, we didn't succeed very well at that. Our hopes for the course, Integrity in the Practice of Molecular Biology, are that it will, one, familiarize future scientists with attitudes that include the ethical impact of their research should it succeed. Two, give them skills and practical reasoning about the right course of action. And three, develop the vocabulary and habits of discourse among scientists, with humanists, and with the general public. As the issues became more complex and more consequential, we came to believe that the language of individual rights and personal choice that have so often characterized medical ethics must yield to a broader perspective in research ethics, that of the welfare of communities and the future of humankind. There have been and were initiated in the early years of this program of responsible conduct of research several studies of the effectiveness of these courses. They touch on changes in attitude and in practice. But for whatever reason, the initial studies of these programs did not show noticeable effects in any of the measured parameters. It became clear that lectures and case studies were not convincing. Alas, this mirrored our experience at Princeton. In the first years, we significantly failed to realize our goals. Students seemed not to learn very much. They lost interest, largely because they resented the loss of time in the laboratory. Young scientists are apt to regard any distraction from their laboratory work as an intrusion and not likely to think that philosophical explorations will aid their scientific work. After several years of frustrating experience, we changed the content of the course and put the burden of classroom discussion on the students themselves, positing that the most effective entry points would be when they saw clear danger to their own research programs. We used techniques that highlighted the risks and disruptions associated with misconduct, authorship disputes, sloppy data management, and laboratory unrest. In order to transfer responsibility to the students, faculty met with the leader students, often on several hour-long occasions, to steer them to sources of information, to help them shape their arguments, and above all, to teach them to engage every single student in each discussion. We minimized issues of right and wrong and shifted the emphasis to choice of action. What would you do in this situation? How would you choose among this alternative and this alternative and this alternative? What would be the consequences of various courses of action? However, the most significant change in our efforts at Princeton and in universities around the country has been that we have undertaken discussions of the social, legal, and ethical consequences of the reproductive technologies, cloning stem cells, human embryonic, and other issues. These research opportunities and in neurobiology and their attendant problems will bring public sentiment and public discourse closer than ever to the heart of the research enterprise in molecular biology. We have been dealing for some time with the consequences of commercialization, but now the issues are closer to the definition of life itself and the very nature of human beings as it becomes possible to change the genetic heritage of future generations. We did not intend, and we will never succeed, in turning natural scientists into philosophers, historians, or ethicists. Arguably, it would not be in the best interests of society to do so. However, these courses in the responsible conduct of research and the social consequences thereof have made vast numbers of young scientists more amenable to participate in interdisciplinary and public discussions of the consequences of the work they do. We now measure our success by the amount of time students discuss the issues after the class, in the hall, standing around and finding out what they really thought. Our course evaluations within the university have improved dramatically, and we look forward to a comprehensive review that the NIH is undertaking at the moment. The contract has been let, and that will be starting immediately. Meanwhile, approximately 16,000 research training positions are funded every year in every major research institutional setting. The budget is about $600 million. Formal instruction in the responsible conduct of research is given not only to those individuals, but to their fellow trainees. These programs have contributed to the establishment of a cadre of active scientific investigators who are willing and prepared to discuss ethical aspects of their work with an increasingly interested public. Thank you.
Bien, on va passer aux questions. Oui, monsieur.
I've been deeply interested in your presentation. Thank you very much. Could you comment on the actual point of the deliberate choice of scientists to act in fields like bioterrorism? And don't you feel that there are other problems in this situation? As I read in an American publication, that the best actors of bioterrorism are Eastern scientists, unemployed scientists. So what can be, I'm a scientist, but what can be the the action, the effect of a substrate like work, position, on the activity, apart from all which has been said to these people before. And also there are scientists which have been involved in anthrax dissemination, apparently. So this is not during the learning. No. This is afterwards. So could you comment on that?
Of course, this. I thank you very much for that question of what scientists can do, particularly biomedical scientists, in confronting the immediate threat of bioterrorism. I think that much as misconduct or scientific fraud is almost always detected by other scientists, until very recently, and probably still today, scientists are unwilling to point the finger at people who are doing things that are very suspicious. Although I think it's risky, the stakes of bioterrorism are so high that if there is a crazy person or a someone who is acting inappropriately, you have pointed out that at least one of the perpetrators of, or alleged perpetrators of, some bioterroristic activities in the United States is a scientist. It is difficult for me to believe that someone did not notice this. Someone could have said, there's something going on here. And I think, although we're reluctant to be suspicious, because our ideal is to be open, I think that that's one thing that can be done. The other is, I think, to get good information to the people who are going to be watching out for these things. The other is to hold hands and stick together. So it's a very frightening time.
I have a relatively plain question. I hope it's a plain question. I think the main trigger for all that heavy, intensive activity of trying to put forward ethical training is the importance of legal actions and the cost of legal actions for institutions. It's a very practical issue, and it involves also students, because the property issue of research results is something which involves students as well. Mm-hmm. When there are challenges about who is really the author of the paper. Can we diffuse the information, the scientific information, or is it to be protected for a while, which is very detrimental to students? I think those legal issues have been the real trigger in universities. My suspicion is that presently the extension will be towards business schools, because of and you mentioned that. I think that the next step is all the ethical issues concerned with the commercial life of the country.
Certainly, when you mention law in the United States, one immediately thinks of being sued, of the tort bar in the United States, which is greatly in need of reform. So I think that is important. But it is also important for students to know what the rules are in order to prevent some of this litigation. There were people at Princeton who plagiarized, who just took someone else's work and handed it in, and then when they were kicked out of the university, they said, you can't do that. There's no rule that says we didn't do it. So there's an increasing amount of codification. We spend a good deal of time on university policies. If your universities are anything like ours, there's a book somewhere, usually on some shelf, that no one ever reads. So it's important that that those policies are at least put under the eyes of every student and that there's some discussion about what they mean.
Another question?
Thank you for your presentation. I just wonder, how do you deal with the problem of private research, and especially in the private research and stem cells? In the fact you are dealing with ethics, and what do you recommend for the private research?
Well, this is an excellent question because in the United States, as you know, there is, largely because of religious influences, people funded with the National Institutes of Health money are forbidden to work on human embryos, and we are still in the process of making enormous compromises to keep the tent large enough to include the research that will have really good effects and not just give it away to the rest of the world. I think that we are going to have enormous problems. Most recently, the states, and one, California in particular, have decided that they will fund research that the National Institutes of Health won't fund. And Dr. Turenne-Moulin's question also speaks to the fact that private money is going to be providing support for this kind of research effort, and it will then escape largely the oversight of that is possible when government funds things. Now, in the case of some of the private entities, they have undertaken in a defensive way independent ethical review panels that are intended to weed out the worst excesses of these activities. I think it's a continuing dilemma. I don't think it will work. I think that time will tell. I understand that Nancy Reagan is very interested, the wife of the former president, Ronald Reagan, is very interested in stem cell research and is pushing the president, President Bush. So there are these winds of change, but above all, legal and commercial activities and the possibility that the inevitability that this work is going to be done somewhere in the world is going to push the situation.
Yes.
How do you envision the relationship between industry and research? I'm saying this, you alluded to the problems of conflict of interest and publication. There has been quite a number of papers about this in the New England Journal of Medicine. You may, perhaps, have you been even involved with this paper, I don't know. But I feel that this is a main issue for most of the journals and probably for most of the clinical research for the meantime. You think they will find some equilibrium? It will be some open space to develop something independently? How is it going on now by now?
It's an excellent question about conflict of interest and industry, largely pharmaceutical and medical device support for research in universities. Princeton University doesn't have a medical school, but there is a research affiliation with Bristol-Myers Squibb that is in the community. We spend a great deal of time in our own course talking about the dangers of that kind of research. There are also many advantages to cooperating with industry. Frequently there's better equipment, it's more modern, you have more support staff. But the danger is that the training of graduate students will be confined to issues that are specifically in the interest of the of that particular commercial entity. The other question that you asked is receiving a great deal of attention. Whether publication in prestigious journals has become, for some companies, a form of advertising. Journal editors in the good journals and the journal editors who participate in two organizations, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors and the World Association of Medical Editors, are on top of the problem. That is, they're working very hard to weed out, or they can't weed it out. What the line of defense has been: full disclosure of all commercial interest. Now, full disclosure of any commercial participation in the research, or even in subsidizing publication in some journals, is at least an alert to readers that they have to keep their skepticism very alive. But it does not address another problem, and that is that there are commercial journals, for-profit journals, that look for all the world like legitimate society-sponsored journals, and they are gussied up to look like the most legitimate journal you can imagine, and then these are distributed. Since I'm at a university, I think education is the answer to most things. And so the doctors really need to know how to be more suspicious.
Je crois que ça sera la conclusion pour cette séance. Merci beaucoup, Patricia. Nous...